The first reading this morning comes from the autobiography of Ted Sorensen, who was President John F. Kennedy's rather celebrated speech writer. He was born to a Russian Jewish mother and a Danish American father who raised him in a Unitarian congregation. And he used to sometimes jokingly call himself a Junitarian.
My Unitarian Church and the Catholic Church into which John F. Kennedy was born stand at opposite ends of the religious spectrum on matters of absolute faith, unchanging doctrine, church-state relations, rituals, symbols, and the obedience of the faithful to a church hierarchy. Thus, it is ironic that the two of us collaborated so well for so long on reducing the obstacle that his Catholic faith posed on his to his hopes for becoming President of the United States. In 1960, when JFK became the Democratic nominee for president, his religion was the single largest negative in his path. Yet by 1963, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association of North America acknowledged that, despite the Catholic position on church-state separation, he had come to value highly JFK's devotion to democracy, peace, and freedom, and his liberalism, reason, and courage. JFK's most notable speech on this subject was his comprehensive address as nominee to the Houston Ministers Association in September 1960. En route to Texas on his campaign plane, as we worked side by side on the final draft of that speech, he laughingly asked whether my years of involvement in this issue on his behalf, my contacts with the Catholic clergymen, and my reading of papal encyclicals had influenced me. "Is any of my Catholicism rubbing off on you?" "No," I replied, "but I think some of my Unitarianism is rubbing off on you." Many of the speeches I drafted reflect Unitarian principles.
The second reading is a powerful roller coaster of a poem written by Merle Collins. She was born in the island of Grenada, and she now teaches at the University of Maryland. I should say Island Nation. This poem was written in 1985 in response to the invasion of her homeland by our own troops under President Reagan. It's called Because the Dawn Breaks.
We speak because when the rain falls in the mountains, the river slowly swells, comes rushing down over boulders, across roads, crumbling bridges that would hold their power against its force. We speak for the same reason that the thunder frightens the child, that the lightning startles the tree. We do not speak to defy your tenets, though we do, or upset your plans, even though we do, or to tumble your towers of Babel. We speak in spite of the fact that we do. We speak because your plan is not our plan. We speak because we dream, because our dreams are not of living in pig pens in any other body's backyard, not of catching crumbs from tables, not of crawling forever along the everlasting ant line, or to veer away in quick detour when the elephant's foot crashes down, not of having to turn back when the smell of death assails our senses, not of striving forever to catch the image of your gods within our creation. We speak for the same reason that the flowers bloom, that the sun sets, that the fruit ripens. Because temples built to honor myths must crumble as the dawn breaks. There is nothing you can do about your feeble bridges when the rain falls in the mountains and swells the flow of rivers. We speak not to agitate you, but in spite of your agitation, because we are workers, peasants, leaders, you see, and we're not born to be your vassals.
I don't know about you, but I wasn't at all surprised by the words uttered by the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, last Tuesday on, of all networks, Fox News. He said, "If you think right now that I give a damn about presidential politics, then you don't know me." Strong words, certainly controversial for many, but perfectly sensible, it seems to me. After all, when you see the videos of the destruction along the Jersey coast, whole neighborhoods flattened and flung about like sawdust caught by a fan blast, even the election day come Tuesday will make less demand of any governor who cares about the fate of the people who elected him, who dares to want to bring them back to their safer lives as quickly as he can. This is ostensibly the same story I told about Clara Barton this morning from our own history. She had many other urgent things to do in the United States in the year 1900, as the leader of the Red Cross especially, but the hurricane in that year that destroyed Galveston and took so many lives understandably claimed her full attention and focus and took her away from other things. I haven't been giving much thought to the election either in the last week. The storm did not blow my house down, but I do love good friends in the affected areas. I'm communicating with them because the storm blew in their area. I'm not talking to my friends in California, where there was no storm. I'm focusing on what is calling to me. Fortunately for me, my closest friends in New York, who live in Queens, right across the river from the United Nations building, did not suffer anything in their particular neighborhood. They were the luckiest people in New York. actually. And they had their electricity the whole time and the internet, and they just stayed home from work for a week, basically. But as you know, on the other side of Queens, from where they are, it was demolished completely. It looked more like a tornado than a hurricane to me, except a very wide tornado that covered so much more territory. Such calamities will indeed eclipse a presidential election for those who are going through it, just as my brother's death from alcoholism last Wednesday before last, eclipsed the presidential election for me and eclipsed much of what I do in my life. It all seems so irrelevant, most of what I do and most of what I partake in this world. All the speeches and the stumping and the ads of the candidates or the phone calls begging me to show up at a meeting for the betterment of the world. My brother's addiction demolished body in a casket trumped them all. Now, of course, this is not news to any of you who have suffered the loss of someone you loved or suffered from the results of a great storm or an earthquake or a tornado or a house fire or a battle in a field in a war across the sea. Such huge events tend to rearrange your priorities and focus your heart on what is demanding your full attention, namely your grief, your loss, your fear, and your recovery. The gloomy moon of your personal experience completely covering, completely eclipsing the sun. The sun, which is still shining and lighting up most other parts of the world. But it's blocked for you by your difficult experience. Because personal eclipses are just that. They're personal. The election this coming Tuesday does not go away because my brother died. It's still going to happen. And the tensions between political parties and religious institutions and cultural circles have been there in your life before the great storm, and they will be there after the great storm and after my losses and your losses. And these divisions always affect our lives, all of our lives. Notice I am calling these tensions between political parties and religions and cultural circles divisions. I could use the other D word, diversity, but I would not be making my point, would I? Our congregational mission statement contains the phrase to claim diversity as a source of our strength. A source of our strength. I do. And the diversity in this place strengthens my spirit, and I think it strengthens the vitality of this congregation. But unless your family is very different from my own, family units don't often make mission statements. And certainly, they're not going to make any mission statement touting diversity as a strength. For in the families that I most hear about in my work, and I do hear your stories, the great word diversity often shrinks down to mere division or divisiveness, especially at presidential election time. Division in some families doesn't seem to strengthen anything, but tears away at the very fabric of the family. Many of you know the story you've told me. Now, not all of you, certainly. But you also heard the same stories that I've heard over the years. Your parents or your grandparents or your in-laws sit around all day watching Fox News as if it was the Oracle of Delphi, Whereas you just hear the word Sean Hannity and you get suddenly sick to your stomach. Your sister-in-law thinks that Michelle Bachmann is finally telling the truth about liberals at last, and you have rolled your eyes so much when she goes on about your heroine that your vision is starting to blur. You talk about a marriage that you attended here at this church between two women, and your aunt from Cleveland starts sermonizing about immorality at the Thanksgiving table, and you just fold your arms, get cross, and stay cross the rest of the day, the great family feast of the year reduced to a plate of simmering resentment. That sort of division is what I'm talking about. Again, not all families are like this. I know quite a few that share religion and politics both, like the Zepka family that I often refer to, Chuck and Jane Zepka and their two kids, Adam and Toby, two of my godchildren. They share it all. There is no divisiveness. But more and more, over the years, people of this congregation have told me about the other kind of family experience, where the divisions, both political and religious, tend to sour the whole family event, whatever it is, and turn time spent with families at holidays into something the nuns, when I was a kid, used to call penance. Is there a solution to this painful experience? Not a solution per se, but a shift of attitude is certainly possible. First, I think it's really important to start off with the first. It's really important never to expect that anyone in your family that watches Fox News 24 hours a day and mostly hangs around with people who do is going to suddenly think like you. For what reason? Why would they do that? How would that happen? Is that magical thinking? Is your expectation a waste of your time? Yes, you've been wasting your time. Do not expect anything else. Foolish expectations cause more frustration and pain than realistic expectations every time. So first, that attitude needs to shift. Second, I think it's important to know that we do affect each other when we get together, when we come together for some particular reason. We affect each other even if we're in completely different camps about many things. And that spending time with folks who are different than you, politically or religiously, is not necessarily a waste of time. I'm thinking about the relationship between President Jack Kennedy and Ted Sorensen, his speechwriter. He wrote the speeches that John F. Kennedy spoke with his mouth. That's an amazingly trusting relationship, maybe more trusting than any family relationship I can think of, much more intimate and close. So President Kennedy comes from an influential Irish Catholic family. Sorensen, calling himself a Unitarian, speaks of both his Danish Lutheran and Jewish roots, all held together by his Unitarian congregation and his Unitarian faithfulness. Remember that wonderful little story you heard? En route to Texas on his campaign plane, as we worked side by side on the final draft of that speech, a speech where he was going to talk about separation of church and state, he laughingly asked whether my years of involvement in this issue on his behalf, my contacts with the Catholic clergymen and reading of papal encyclicals had influenced me. Is any of my Catholicism rubbing off on you? He asked me. No, I replied, but I think some of my Unitarianism is rubbing off on you. Many of the speeches that I drafted reflect Unitarian principles. And that points out an important understanding, too, that when we are together, the way that we influence each other is not necessarily 50-50. It may be 100-0 in some cases. That happens. Or 20-80 or something like that. And I think that's important to realize, too, that the way we influence each other is not this 50-50 thing that, again, it's a bad expectation. It's a misunderstanding of the word fairness. They both stayed in the conversation with each other, these two from totally different religious and political backgrounds, Sorensen and Kennedy. In my life, I've tried to stay in the conversation, too. It's not always easy. I could never manage with my father. It was almost impossible. But after many years, I was able to stay in conversation with my mother so long and so faithfully that my mother came to understand who I am as a man who loves other men in this society where that's still a controversial idea. She hated it at first. She resisted it. She resented it. She believed her religion about it. She cried about it. How could she otherwise, I ask, since I told her who I was in 1965, before there was any support for her or for me in any way, shape, or form at all? I sometimes jokingly refer to that as the pre-Oprah era. But there was nothing. There was no television. There was no book. There was no knowledge. There was no information any place. So for me to have expected her to have understood would have been a waste of my time, too. And I told her that. Don't feel bad about all the things you went through. But we stayed in the conversation, and she stayed in the conversation with me, and it was hard for her, and it was hard for me. And the single most moving day in my life, and I'm 63 years old, so count the days. Single most moving day in my life was toward the end of my mother's own life, when she took my hand and she thanked me for staying in the conversation and apologized tenderly to me for not accepting me sooner, and beautifully, for not flying out to California to stand by my side as I buried my friends who had died of AIDS. After all, she said, that's one of the things that mothers are for, to be there for their kids, the kids they have always loved. Now, if your family is abusive and cruel, and God knows they exist, I understand that, then maybe one of the saner things for you to do at these times is to control the timing of the visits or to set some boundaries in advance. And I've known people who have to not see their families for that reason. It's sad, but reality is reality. If there is a history of political and religious baiting, it's okay to say, before you go, I will be there on Thanksgiving, but as soon as Uncle Theodore goes off on his tangent about those goddamn liberals, I'm getting up and walking away. I'm not going to listen to it. I'm sorry. If you don't want that to happen, then you might want to have a talk with him first. This strong but clear approach has worked for many that I know of. They assert their own portion of membership in the family and refuse to spend all of their time on the defensive. And most often, Uncle Theodore behaves. But third, the most important thing for anyone who is fearful of spending time with certain family members because of divisive events that cloud the potential camaraderie is to get clear about what is really important for you to stand up for. Where do you draw the line? What is clearest for you? Spending large amounts of time fiercely arguing with hot language about politics and religion is one of the great time wasters of all time, if it's done in that way. It's a demonstration, I think, more of mutual self-righteousness, which accomplishes nothing as far as I'm concerned. That's not staying with the conversation, that's trying to win. Never a great idea. But if both can stay in the conversation over the years, then it's important for you to be clear about what it is that's most dear to you, what is basic to you. And that's why I like Merle Collins' poem so much. The clarity, the absolute clarity. We do not speak to defy your tenets. We're not here to beat you down, although you may feel that way. We're not here to upset your plans, although that may happen, or to tumble your towers of Babel. We speak because your plan is not our plan. We speak because your plan is not our plan. You're being clear. Your dream, she says, is not our dream. We do not dream of living in pig pens in somebody else's backyard. We don't dream of catching crumbs from the table. We'd like to actually eat, have part in the feast. We speak not to agitate you, that is, not to argue with you or spite you or hate you or prove that you're evil, but in spite of your agitation. You brought this up, I didn't. Because we are workers and we're peasants and we're leaders and we're doctors and we're mechanics and we're barbers and we're teachers. And you see, we were not born to be your vassals, that is, your slaves, your inferiors, or the people whom you blame. We weren't born to that, and we're not going to take it. I love her clarity. This is my dream. This is my plan for my life. I live my own life. I speak it out loud in response to you saying that you have a plan and you have a dream for my life that I don't want. That's all. That's it. This kind of clarity spoken kindly and without tiptoeing up to it can often turn difficult conversations into real conversations. Not always, but often enough. It's the clarity, the avoidance of slogans, the political and religious catchphrases, and the embrace of deeper and more sovereign words, my plan, my dream, which can reframe some conversations around the table at holiday time. The divisiveness can sometimes be yanked over a few more degrees, closer to the more holy and respectable word, diversity, which, as I said, strengthens and does not hurt. The election will soon, I pray, be over. The signs will come down. My email box will cease to be polluted. The houses in New Jersey, where Christie is governor, and in New York, where Cuomo is governor, will slowly be rebuilt. As each leader, both Democrat and Republican in this case, both focus on what is most important right now, the lives and livelihoods of the citizens that they serve. As Clara Barton did long before them, demonstrating beautifully the practice of our universalist faithfulness, to show up when it's time to show up, and then to work for the common good.